This is URN Sport.
So the first story we're going to go to today involves the England cricket team and their one-day internationals against Bangladesh, which Arve is covering for us.
Thank you, Joe. England and Bangladesh have gone head-to-head in two games up till now of the three-game series at Dhaka, where England have clinched the first game. They won the game by 21 runs, where debutant Jake Bowl has got a haul of 5 wickets and he started in the game. Ben Stokes also got 101 in that game as well. And the second game, which had a lot of tension in it, we actually lost the game by 34 runs due to the poor start from our batsman, which we scored only 26 for the loss of the first 4 wickets. And then came along Josh Butler, who scored 57. Well, as he went along, Mashraf Ahmedrezza clinched 4 wickets like in consecutive rounds, and then just we lost the game by 34 runs.
I guess the real talking point in that game was, of course, Joss Butler's reaction to the Bangladesh players celebrating the fact that he'd got out. Do you guys think it was a case of indiscipline from just Joss Butler, or do you think it was a bit of both parties there?
I do think clearly this was Bangladesh's fault, as they were the ones who were fined and Joss Butler was just reprimanded. Joss Butler is genuinely a cool player on and off the pitch, but due to the situation, the emotions were running high. They were getting down out fast, but then Bangladesh players went ahead to him and then they initiated him. So I believe Joss Butler was right at that point. He had to react to that. He was the captain, so there was no choice for him. He had to go through it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to have to agree. You know, it was absolutely, you know, it was uncalled for from Bangladesh. Yes, you get a wicket of Joss Butler. Butler, what did he score? 57, I think it was?
Yeah, 57.
For England, you know, our highest scorer. And to get him out, yes, it's a big achievement, but you just don't celebrate like that. You know, you don't get right in the opposition's face. Yes, some sort of sledging is okay. You know, we see sledging happen in day-to-day county cricket, but, you know, celebrating like that is just absolutely uncalled for.
Yeah, one more point. The Bangladesh a player who was given a 20% fine was Sabir Rahman, and that was his third fine, and one more fine by him, and he gets banned for 2 or 3 more games at tests and ODI, whichever comes first. So he's a player of misconduct at the moment.
And I think the more important point is that the Bangladesh captain Murtaza was also fined. You know, he's the captain of the Bangladesh team. You'd expect him to be setting an example for the rest of his team, but he's going out there using, I don't know what he said, but he's obviously triggered Joss Butler, and
I'm
he's just come out.
I'm not sure if he actually said anything, or has he just got fined because it's his team and he's fairly controlled.
Possibly,
his
players. Yeah. But I mean, that's the thing. He must, like you say, you know, he is their captain. He must be able to control that team. You know, he must. Yes, there are going to be some situations where they are going to get a bit heated under the collar, and you know, you are as a captain, that is your responsibility to control that, and it's just absolutely uncalled for from both teams. I mean, yes, perhaps just you can have an argument for the fact that Joss Butler shouldn't have maybe reacted the way that he did, but it is just absolutely unacceptable from both teams.
Yes,
certainly is. I mean, the punishment really reflects that. Like you say, Jack, any kind of captain in any sports team has a duty to keep their players under control and look after them. But the performance on the second day takes nothing away from a really good England performance on the first day, where of course debutant Jake Bowl had a really good match, and Ben Stokes, didn't they?
Well, Jake Bowl had a 5 wicket haul on that day, and leg spinner Adil Rashid as well performed really well, like restricting the team. Bangladesh should score 271 for the loss of 4 wickets, and then in a span of 12 runs they got all out. So kudos to Jake Bowl. And Ben Stokes, obviously he's getting better by time. So
I'm not sure it was England's best performance. I think they got away with it a bit, got away with the win there, because Bangladesh should have easily chased that down from 271 for 4. So I think we got away with that.
Hi, I'm Lauren Herrier, your SU sports officer, and you're listening to URN Sport.
And now we're going to go over to Lee, who's got some news on the weekend's Formula One action for you.
Happy days, yeah. Lewis Hamilton had a great race. He started off in second place, and he then, within about 5 seconds, was down to 8th, thanks to a poor start, likely induced by this season's changes to the start procedures. So the driver have a few different clutches to operate, which makes the start procedure a bit more difficult. So he just didn't get away. He bogged down and immediately found himself down in 8th place. But on the start, credit to the two Ferrari drivers who almost came together. But it was just, you know, this was crunch time for Lewis Hamilton. If he was going to get back in the Taichi race, he had to win at Suzuka and then win the 4 consecutive Grand Prix after. But, you know, he fought a losing battle from the lights out and then came to finish 3rd behind an impressive young Max Verstappen. And Nico Rosberg has a 33-point lead, and Hamilton obviously needs to overcome that. But even if he won every race and Nico Rosberg came in behind him, he wouldn't be able to recoup the deficit. So it's not looking good. Not looking good at all.
So certainly isn't. But do you think, Lee, that that's kind of credit to Nico Rosberg's driving, the fact he's kind of persisted and chased Lewis Hamilton throughout the Formula One season for so long?
I think after they came back from the last break that Nico Rosberg has probably looked at his best. But I will of course be biased, I'm a British fan, but at the same time I'm not a great fan of Lewis Hamilton. But I just don't think Nico Rosberg is in that top calibre of driver. You know, if you look at the grid, the amount of champions on there at the moment, I don't think Nico Rosberg is cream of the crop and the same as those guys. So, and Hamilton, as we know, has had a lot of engine failures and bits and bobs going wrong. And Nico Rosberg's got the rub of the green, which, you know, that happens in Formula One. And that might be the difference between grasping a title or not. But I would attribute it to Hamilton's failures rather than Nico Rosberg's good efforts.
You discuss Hamilton's failures there. I mean, he hasn't won a race since the 31st of July. His off the track antics have also been subject to debate and concern as well, saying that he's not been able to not going to talk to social media or the press or things like that. Jack, do you think that's kind of conducive to someone who's trying to go for the championship?
I think it's the media. Sort of, the media plays a massive role in, you know, of course in all sports, and I think that you know, Hamilton is obviously feeling the pressure, not just from his team, but from the media as well. You know, he from the British media, you know, we're expecting him. You know, he's won it for the last several years now, and we always expect him to come out on top. And, you know, Rosberg, credit where credit's due, Rosberg has raced phenomenally this season. But, you know, going back to when we were talking about it last week as well, you know, you've got Mercedes, the German constructor, and you've got Rosberg, the German driver. They've had an English champion for the last 3 years. Maybe there is a bit of a conspiracy there, but I'm not going to, like, again, you know, you can read into it however you want, but I do think that Hamilton is definitely feeling pressure from the media. And yeah, you know, ever since he's had his parts changed on his car, it just seems that something has gone wrong with his car, and I'm not too sure what's going on. Obviously, last week we had his engine blow out when he was leading for the 40-odd laps, and, you know, he hasn't really managed to recover. And like Lee said, you know, even if Hamilton does finish first in the last 4 races of the season, he's going to need Rosberg to, you know, finish outside the top, outside the points on at least 2 of them, you know, because that's really the only way that he'll be able to do it.
I think Hamilton is slowly cracking under pressure. Like, he's the defending champion, so I think Mercedes need to get a bit relaxed on him as well now, because Rosberg, genuinely, I believe he deserves it this year. He's been behind Hamilton for 2 consecutive years now.
You are listening to the URN Sports Show. Now, we are going to go on to news of the China Open, which Naomi was covering for us this week.
It's been a fantastic year for the British number one. Andy Murray has secured his 40th singles title and 5th title of 2016. Yesterday, Andy Murray won 6-4, 7-6, 7-2 in the tiebreak in the China Open final against Bulgarian Grigor Dimitrov. Murray has proved his critics wrong and shown how powerful he is and why he is the world number two. During the China Open last week, Murray showed us that he can compete well consistently on the big stage, with just one other tiebreak against fellow Brit Carl Edmund, and without dropping a set, Murray displayed almost faultless performances throughout the week. With Djokovic missing the China Open due to injury, Murray used this opportunity to narrow the gap on the world number one, leaving Britain in good hands under the British number one Andy Murray. Things were also looking better for the women's British number one Joanna Konta, also reaching the China Open final, but unfortunately was on the losing side. Agnieszka Radwańska defeated Joanna Konta 6-4, 6-2. Konta was unlucky to lose in the end, but this week Konta became the first British woman for 32 years to make the world top 10.
Thank you very much for that, Naomi. First of all, we'll have a little chat about Andy Murray again on the Tuesday Sports Show. His 5th singles title of 2016, Harry. It's been a fantastic year for him, hasn't it? And this kind of just adds to the success, albeit not against the most illustrious of opposition, Gregor Dimitrov, but certainly a job that needed doing.
Yeah, you can only beat what's put in front of you, can't you? And yeah, he's slowly closing the gap on Djokovic as world number one. And he's got three Grand Slam finals, I think, this year?
Yeah, three.
Winning one of them, winning Wimbledon again. So I think it's been a very good year for him. And he's obviously won Olympic gold as well, and almost got Britain through to another Davis Cup final, so looking good for Andy Murray.
What do you think has kind of been key to the success for him? Obviously he had the changing coach with Ivan Lendl coming back in. Do you think that had an impact upon proceedings?
Yeah, I think mentally more than anything, more than game plan, I think make him more mentally strong that he can beat Djokovic, because when he had more success against Djokovic, it was when Lendl was coached 2 or 3 years ago. So I think that's right. Yeah,
I think having Lendl is I think we can't actually play off enough how important Lendl is. I mean, looking at him on the sideline, if you've got the same temperament as Lendl on the court, then you're going to be sorted, because you just don't care what happens, you're just going to focus. And I think that's always been the problem with Andy Murray, when he just, his emotions are a bit out of check and he takes it too far, and you're like, come on Andy, focus, because we all know how good he is. If Andy Murray's at the top of his game, you back him to grow and win everything, and I think he's the best player in the world alongside Djokovic. I'm not sure Djokovic has had the form of recent that he was once so rampant with, so I think Andy Murray's, with Lendl, is the dream team for him, and hopefully he'll go and do one time, a 4 Grand Slams in a year. Well, that's maybe optimistic thinking at the moment, but go on, Andy.
Of course, in the field of British talent in tennis, we have to talk about Joanna Konta, who made it to the final of the China Open. Was defeated, however, in straight sets by Agnieszka Radwańska in the final, 6-4, 6-2, who Radwańska is the world number 3. So it was a game she would have expected to win, but nonetheless, Konta's up to the into the top 10 in terms of women's world rankings in tennis. Harry, isn't that such a great achievement, not just for her, but for British women's tennis in general, because it's something we haven't been able to say for such a long time?
Yeah, I think Murray's obviously been an inspiration preceding this, and now Konta will be an inspiration for all girls and all British tennis players out there. And I think it's credit to Judy Murray, who's had a big influence in the women's game over the last few years, and it's a really big achievement for Konta, and she should get better and better. I think maybe could be a Grand Slam winner if the draw's right, if she gets lucky, you never know.
Do you think she's kind of part of a broader trend? Obviously, there's people like Carl Edmund and Heather Watson as well, Laura Robson. They're all kind of coming through and have broken through in the last sort of year or so. Do you think, Lee and Harry, that these players are riding on the success of Murray?
I think they finally realised that it's not actually like impossible to get higher up in the rankings, as Konta has shown by being 146, I think, July last year, to go into 9th. Just over a year later, it's just incredible. And Carl Edmund's just broken into the world top 50 as well, so it's looking up for British tennis at the moment.
I think it's nice to see that, because I mean, Carl Edmund at his stage in his career was probably not too different to where Tim Henman was, but Carl Edmund now has a great idol, obviously, in Andy Murray, which I think, as we were just saying, that having someone who's done it and been there, it's so much easier, and to actually visualise you getting to the pinnacle of the sport, which is hopefully what people like Carl Edmund can do, because Andy Murray will hopefully inspire a new generation of tennis players, however cheesy it may sound. But that is obviously what great sportsmen can do. So
me and Ed Robinson, the usual guest on the Tuesday sports show, we took a trip down to Highfields Park last week, where we encountered Dylan Hartley, the England rugby captain, who we interviewed about touch rugby participation, as well as his England and Northampton career. During England's biggest ever year of rugby in 2015, O2 wanted to harness the power of grassroots support and get more people playing O2 touch. The O2 Touch Tour took to the road, staging 4 events in Loughborough, Bath, Manchester and London. Activities and entertainment were provided for all ages and abilities. On Wednesday, the 5th of October 2016, the scheme came to Nottingham, where Dylan Hartley, the England Rugby Union captain, was present. Me and Ed took a trip down to Highfields Park yesterday to find out more about the O2 Touch Rugby scheme.
So I am delighted to be joined. It is an absolute privilege to be joined by Dylan Hartley, the England Rugby Union captain. Now, Dylan, first of all, could you tell listeners a little bit about the O2 Torch scheme and explain to them what your role was within that?
I think the key thing we're looking to do here and on the O2 Touch Tour is to get people to get playing touch, any age, any sex. I think that's what touch rugby is perfect for. We obviously take the contact element out of the game, so anyone can play. We take the technical aspects out of the game, like scrums, lineouts, all the confusing things, and we simplify the game basically. The game is based on agility, you know, so footwork and handling skills, catching, passing, offloading. So it's a great advert for the game, and anyone can play. So it's great to see so many people out here today having a good time, getting active.
Certainly. Do you think the initiative will encourage people to take up touch rugby as a main sport for those that may be sort of slightly put off or discouraged from the contact side of the game?
Definitely. It's a great thing. You don't need large numbers to play. Obviously, I think we've got 8-a-side here today, 7 or 8-a-side. I mean, I used to play as a kid, like, you know, 2-on-2, or I even played in the back garden with my brothers, you know, 1-on-2, which is pretty, you know, the outcomes, it wasn't the most entertaining game. But you don't need a lot of people. You don't need a lot of equipment. You just need a ball. And I mean, even going back to when I was a kid and at school, if we didn't have a rugby ball, we'd tie a jumper into knots and we'd play with that. So it's a good game. It's simple and it's fun.
And how important on a broader scale is it for people to know about these participation opportunities in touch rugby as well as the contact discipline that they may not have heard about or may not know about?
I think we're just trying to tap into a wider group of people, I think. So, like I said, any age, girls and boys, anyone can play. And I think the other important thing is the core skills it kind of teaches, the handling. And like you said, without the contact element, you can focus on these things like your agility and your catching and your passing. So it's good for development in that aspect.
Dylan, what was your reaction following the phone call from Eddie Jones for you to captain the English national side?
It wasn't actually a phone call. It was an invite to breakfast, and I was a little bit nervous. So it seemed like an eternity driving down to where we met and had breakfast. But yeah, I was very nervous actually. But obviously excited and about the challenge ahead when he offered me the job. And I'm ever excited going forward as well. You know, it's all about the next game for us. And for me, as a captain, I'm always judged on my next performance. So it's kind of keeping me on my toes to keep performing and being a part of the team.
Talking of going forward, how do you think England are going to do in the Autumn Internationals? Because you've had quite a positive start under Eddie Jones.
So we've drawn a line under our pass. You know, the last season was very good for us. A great start as a new team. But we've drawn a line under that. The next challenge is South Africa. All our focus has been on that. We've had a couple of mini camps where we're preparing for that game, and you know, I'd like to think by the time that game's comes around, we're going to be, you know, we're going to be raring to go, because we're going to be mentally prepared and physically, you know, battle hardened from a good start to a Premiership and European season. We'll be ready for that game.
Absolutely. And just finally, how do you think Northampton are going to fare in this year's Aviva Premiership?
Yeah, we're, you know, by our own standards, we had a rocky season last year. First time we finished outside of the playoffs. So we've set our stall out this year to be in that top four and to push for silverware. And I think early season, it's good not to get too carried away. We've had a few mixed results, mixed performances. A few results have got away from us. We haven't played our best rugby. But if you look at the table, we're still there or thereabouts. So it's a long season, a lot of time for us to improve. And I've got no doubt we'll be sniffing around the top of the table towards the end of the season and hopefully pushing for silverware.
Perfect. Thank you. An absolute honour to talk to you.
Thank you very much. Cheers, guys.
This is URN Sport.